Novelist Lionel Shriver does not shy away from the uncomfortable. Her novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, centered on a mother confronting her own possible culpability in her son's school attack. Then there was 2010's So Much for That, which addressed the U.S. healthcare system. 2014's Big Brother, which looked at obesity and our relationship with food. Well, now Lionel Shriver takes on the often wince-inducing role of stuff, our property, and its effect on our relationships, in a collection of short story fiction. In one story, a couple's home renovation destroys their marriage. An embezzler flees justice and his wife, but the island paradise he settles in becomes a living hell. Long-ago lovers, now best friends, are torn apart when the new girlfriend doesn't want the old one around. This is Lionel's first short story collection, Property, Stories Between Two Novellas, and she joins us from the BBC studios in London. Lionel Shriver, welcome back.
It's nice to talk to you again, Robin.
Boy, I love this collection, and often so painful to read.
I beg to differ. You know, in comparison to my novels, this book is a walk in the park.
Well, actually, there's a lot of humor in it. But start with The Standing Chandelier. It's about Gillian Frisk and Weston Babansky. Frisk and Baba, they call themselves. Best friends after a brief sexual encounter years earlier. They talk about everything. They play tennis together. They are the perfect best friends. Then enter Baba's new girlfriend, Paige. Suddenly, unbeknownst to Gillian, Paige starts planting seeds of doubt about her. And bam, Baba breaks off their friendship. It's heartbreaking. So why drive this to that painful end?
I'm interested in asking the question as to whether or not men and women can ever just be friends. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sympathetic with everyone in this scenario, and that includes the girlfriend who's new on the scene and is trying to get a feel for this close friendship that goes back 25 years. And it's like, who is this woman? Mm-hmm. And she immediately takes a dislike to a woman that she perceives as potentially a romantic rival, but more to the point, a rival for intimacy with her boyfriend. She doesn't like how close they are.
Well, and the property in this story, I think, is the Standing Chandelier, which is this bizarre piece of art that Gillian made and presented to them for their wedding present. And it was such a symbol of her weirdness and quirkiness that at first Paige is like, oh, I hate that thing. Then they both decide that they want it and they keep it. So they keep her wedding present, don't allow her to come to the wedding. Property. Talk about that idea.
Well, I'm interested in property as a projection of the self. You know, when you buy a house, for example, that's you. That's your house. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things about the concept of ownership is the fact that it is mostly, if not primarily, defined by the fact that not only is this yours, but it's not anyone else's. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of patrolling of the boundary between you and other people. Mm-hmm. And that's why the concept of property, of ownership, becomes so emotionally charged.
Well, so the property in that story actually could have been Baba, the man.
That's what they're really tussling over. Yeah. And that's what Paige, the girlfriend who becomes his wife, is really getting to keep.
Yes, it's very sad. In another story, there's a parents of a middle-aged child who will not leave the home. He's happy
there.
Which
is a pretty commonplace situation.
Very common. It's throat-tightening, but it's hilarious. They decide, well, they're just going to throw him out. Instead, he lives on the front lawn with all his belongings, becomes an internet sensation. People start picketing on his behalf. How can you throw him out? He becomes this worldwide sensation. They are cowed not only into bringing him back into the house, but they give up their master bedroom to him, his girlfriend, and their new baby. What a horror.
I had great fun with that story. I'm interested in the fact that when you look at that situation, you would think that the parents were in a position of power. But the trouble is that when you have a heart, advantage is a disadvantage. Their son's very helplessness, his weakness, he can't survive in the outside world. That means that he has all the power, ironically, because that dependency makes him vulnerable and helpless and someone who needs to be taken care of. And if you're going to be a decent parent, you don't abuse that. I'm also interested in that situation of overlapping territory. Most parents will recognize this. If you have an adult child living at home, it becomes a little awkward whose house it is. After all, when your children are growing up, your house is their house. But by convention, they leave the nest and you get your house back. But if they don't leave home, there's a real tension between who owns that house in an emotional way and even in a who determines what happens to what room. Can they raid the refrigerator, or are they expected to go shopping for their own food? It becomes complicated. And of course, that is great stuff for a fiction writer.
And is it great stuff that you are seeing? You have borrowed from your own stories, and you talked about your novels being, you know, lacerating at times. And one of them, Big Brother, which looked at morbid obesity, you had a brother who died of morbid obesity, you told us when you were here before. You know, how much as a writer are you excavating your own stories?
I think all writers excavate their own lives. I mean, after all, you only have your own experience. So everything I know about the world is through my little lived life.
Well, how much do these stories reflect your life? In another one, a man has a meltdown in a TSA airport line. You also could have lost your temper at security at an airport.
Which is not a good idea.
Have you actually gone to the denouement that he did, which was being dragged into a back room?
I haven't gone that far, but I do have a temper on me, and you do not want to go through airport security with me. I have very little patience for stupid rules that don't work.
So that is you.
I exaggerated my own tendency, and in some ways I wrote that to chastise myself, to please, please, please keep your mouth shut.
In other words, do it here on the page and then show the terrible consequences of that and don't do it yourself.
Right.
Right.
The point of that scene was that the character had been under his elderly father's thumb for years, and one more time he's going back to visit his father, who is ostensibly at death's door. Mm-hmm. And he's very resentful. He's made this trip over and over again, and the guy always pulls through. And then he finally draws the line and stands up for himself in the worst possible place to stand up for yourself in all of the United States, airport security.
Yeah. And by the way, the property in this story, a small chapstick, which is the offending thing in his pocket, which has gotten him pulled over in the first place. And as he sits in this detention that he's now in, that chapstick becomes a connection to his father.
That particular detail is, strangely enough, quite autobiographical because my father always used those plain chapsticks, you know, the ones with the black wrapper.
Sure.
And that smell and even that texture, that because it's especially waxy, I always associate with him and being kissed on the cheek as a kid. He would leave behind that smell, which is very masculine to me.
This is your writing that we've just come to love. After her breakup with her friend Baba in the first story we talked about, Jillian would migrate on her own to their tennis bench, kneeling on the ground, resting her forehead on the rough paint-peeling front slat in a position that only could have been called prayerful, and then she wailed from the part of the body from which one is taught to sing opera. The father of the son who won't move out, who spends hours on a website, manhole.com, which really is for people who love manhole covers. The father asks his wife, "Do you not like our son?" She says, "No, it's not dislike. All that idleness is oppressive. It lowers the barometric pressure of the whole house." Great writing. But it's in this short story form. How do you know? How do you know when something, a bolt of lightning hits you? Oh, a couple laid back, suddenly they buy a house, start renovating it, and he turns into, you know, a fascist practically. You know, how do you know that that's a short story and not a novel?
A short story you can kind of hold in your head, and I'm likely to conceive of it pretty much beginning, middle, and end. A novel is much more unwieldy, and there's something about it that seems intrinsically unresolved, whereas the short story is more like a little gift, and it's already all wrapped up. It is a complete experience in a discrete period of time, and that can be very satisfying.
Well, these definitely are gifts, and they definitely are, although people will be reading them screaming half the time, "No, don't do that." You know, it's just property. That's Lionel Shriver. The new book is Property. Lionel, thank you so much.
Oh, I really enjoyed talking to you.